last week of part one. I hope that you find cosmology sufficiently interesting, that you stick around for part two, which will be even more exciting than part one, I absolutely promise you. So let's finish up our discussion of the thermal history of the universe, and then the plan for the rest of the week is to talk about inflationary cosmology, and that will be the last topic for part one. Okay, so last time we talked about the Boltzmann equation, which if we integrate that sort of primordial form of the Boltzmann equation, we could express things in terms entirely of number densities. So this equation was appropriate for thinking about the evolution of quantities that are more or less homogeneous throughout the universe. Okay, so the form, if we have processes that involve 2-to-2 interactions, so particle 1 and particle 2 going to particle 3 and particle 4, could be written as such. So we had something that told us about the conservation of particle 1, the number of number density of particle 1, which could be violated if there was some rate for 1 to interact with 2 and give us 3 and 4. And there were two interesting regimes within which we can solve most problems that we can cast in this sort of 2-to-2 way. So in the regime where the interaction rate is far greater than the time scale set by the expansion of the universe, which was Hubble, then things are interacting sufficiently such that the stuff over here basically establishes an equilibrium. And we can solve the Saha equation, which is basically that this term in brackets is zero. And then as, the interaction rate becomes less than Hubble, which in many processes happens eventually, we get freeze out, which basically means that the right-hand side of this equation is approximately zero. And therefore, we can basically just say that the number density of particles is conserved, okay, up to a cubed. So things just dilute. Okay, so that's kind of the rough solution. Okay, we talked about in lecture BBN. So just to recap what happened there. We can have processes like this that can make neutrons convert to protons. And when the universe is really hot, this is really efficient. Okay. And then eventually, we get neutron proton freeze out. So what do? We do Saha to get the ratio of the number density of neutrons to the number density of protons as a function of temperature. Okay. And then eventually there is a temperature at which this interaction stops being efficient, and then we can calculate the freeze out number density of these of neutrons to protons. And we calculated that to be something like 0.2. It's like 1 out of 5. Okay, so we've got a bunch of neutrons and protons hanging out. Those neutrons and protons would like to combine to form nuclei because we can get binding energy out, okay, by forming nuclei. And that would have happened immediately except for there are tons of photons around that like to break apart the nuclei that I just formed. And so after a little while, we get neutrons and protons forming deuterium. And again, we basically wait around until this interaction becomes efficient. In this case, we can just use Saha to get the ratio of deuterium, neutrons, and protons. And this interaction is always efficient. And so we basically just suck up all the neutrons into deuterium until there are no neutrons left. Okay, it never freezes out, it just stays in equilibrium. And then you can apply a small correction because the neutrons are unstable and this process takes so long that some of those neutrons decay and so on and so forth. And you can get an estimate of how many deuterium atoms there are per proton based on that. And then eventually we can form heavier elements by combining deuterium with a proton, for example. And that can make helium-3 plus a photon. And then those helium-3s can combine with a neutron to give you helium-4, for example, and so on and so forth. This also happens really fast because helium-4, lots of binding energy. So you want to get there so you can release that energy. And eventually, you don't even need to solve Saha. This just is so efficient that, you know, all the neutrons that you started with up here end up in helium-4. And then we calculated YP, which was the energy density in helium-4. Over the total energy density in baryons, and this is something like 0.26. And that was sort of where we ended up with BBN. Okay. And things stop here because, again, if we thought about the binding energy per atomic number, helium-4 was this kind of big blip. And then there's a gap, actually. So there's nothing at 5. There's just no stable nucleon. And then eventually you can make some lithium and some beryllium. And you're left over with a little bit of that deuterium, a little bit of tritium. But mostly you just have helium-4. OK, so we covered that. And then the next significant event in the thermal history of the universe has to do with the formation of the cosmic microwave background radiation. So that will be our next topic. Okay, so we had BBN. And again, if we thought about this temperature time plot, we had sort of MeV scales where we had BBN going on. And then once we form atomic nuclei, the next thing we can form is neutral atoms, right? So the next thing that we can do in order to make bound states happens down at EV scales. So this is where neutrons and protons gave me atomic nuclei. And here, this event recombination is where electrons and protons can give us neutral hydrogen plus energy. All right. So there's sort of three events that we can talk about that happen almost simultaneously, but are slightly different. Okay. So event number one is recombination. So this is where we study the interaction of protons and electrons combining to form hydrogen and a photon, and a hydrogen getting hit by a photon to form protons and electrons. So if you've got a bunch of charges around, photons like to interact with charges, but by making neutral hydrogen, I'm removing charges. Okay, and so photons don't like to necessarily interact with neutral hydrogen except for to ionize it. Okay, and of course that takes a certain amount of energy. So once I no longer have photons that have an energy greater than 13.6 electron volts, then, well, the only thing they can do is scatter from free electrons and free protons. And they like to scatter from electrons better because electrons are lighter. Okay. So the next thing that happens is decoupling. Okay, and that is where basically Thomson scattering becomes inefficient because the number of electrons around is getting pitifully small, and so this just stops happening. Okay, and then the third thing that happens is last scattering. So the charges become so few that any photons that are left over after this interaction just will not interact with anything. Okay, they will not scatter again until they hit one of our telescopes, for example. Okay. Okay, so photons just travel. Okay. Now, how do you know? Well, okay, so this, after this happens, is what leads to the cosmic microwave background radiation. Okay. Now, why is there a CMB in the first place? Okay. Remember that the number of photons drastically overwhelms the number of baryons. So when we think about all these interactions, there's always going to be lots of photons left over. There's always way more photons than baryons. And so the reason we have a significant CMB is that the baryon to photon ratio is really tiny. So again, we come back to this number that is really fundamental in cosmology. That small means a lot. Okay, so let's cover these three topics. Yeah, question.
What would happen if we do not have enough photons? Are they will combine with electrons?
Well, so you'd need some processes. So what you'd do is you'd basically remove all the photons that had the right energy. And you'd be left with some other photons, right? Thomson scattering doesn't really change their energy.
Yes.
So we'd get a gas of photons with a bunch of gaps in it, right? That correspond to all these recombination lines. And there wouldn't be so many of them, right? So the intensity of the CMB would be pretty low because we just wouldn't really have that many photons around. And we'll see that that's not really the case, yeah?
I see.
So we get this nice black body spectrum of photons. It's really bright, and so on and so forth. And the reason for that is this. Good question. Okay, so let's think about these three epochs. So following the recipe again, we can go to high enough temperatures where SAHA applies. So the interaction rates are high. By the way, for most of these processes involving electrons and photons, the interaction rates are usually pretty high, right? Because, well, E and M is the strongest force. Things like to scatter. If there are photons and electrons around, they're gonna interact. Okay, so let's think about recombination. Okay, so we want to think about this 2-to-2 process. We have the recipe up there for 2-to-2 processes. Just like we argued for before, because the baryon to photon ratio is so tiny, there's so many more photons, this interaction is not really going to change the equilibrium distribution for photons. And that would be one difference if we assumed that eta was not tiny, right? We'd have to consider that too. Okay, so that means our Saha equation is just going to involve hydrogen and the number density of protons and electrons. Okay, so that's the equation we got. We can recall that, thinking about the energies or temperatures that we're interested in, you can guess that they're of order the binding energy, at least, of hydrogen. And that's 13.6 electron volts. So the temperature, you can think, is going to be of order, say, tens of electron volts. And that temperature is way below the mass of the proton and the electron. So we're like very comfortably in the non-relativistic regime. So we can just remember what the non-relativistic distribution of protons and electrons is in equilibrium, likewise for hydrogen. And we can end up with an equation that tells us the relative number density of hydrogen, protons, and electrons. And that's given by the following. If we assume that the mass of hydrogen is approximately equal to the mass of the proton, which for the prefactor is fine. Okay, so that's the binding energy of hydrogen. That's just the mass of the proton plus the mass of the electron minus the mass of hydrogen. And that's 13.6 electron volts. Okay, so in equilibrium, that's how things are going to go. So basically what's going to happen is we're going to eat up these guys into hydrogen. And let's define the ionization fraction. So that's going to be the number of electrons over the number of baryons. Okay, let's approximate the number of baryons by the number of protons plus the number of hydrogen atoms. So then from this, the number of hydrogen atoms over the number of protons is just 1 minus x over x. Solving this. What I wanted. Okay, so then we can plug this into the Saha equation, get an equation for x. We can use the baryon to photon ratio again, just like we did for the neutrons. And end up with an equation that looked like this. Okay, so we can define what, we mean by recombination or solve this exactly. Let's cheat. let's just define recombination as the temperature where basically 50% of the universe is ionized, so 50% of the baryons are hydrogen. Okay, and you can solve that. It doesn't happen around where the exponent equals 1 for the same reason that BBN didn't happen, or neutron-proton freeze-out didn't happen at temperatures of order in MeV because of this really tiny number in the front. So we need to grow this exponent big to compete with the smallness of eta. Okay, and so it turns out that x equals 1/2 at temperatures of order 0.32 electron volts. Okay, so significantly below the binding energy by a factor of like 10 or 100. Okay. It's like 3760 degrees Kelvin. So we know the scale factor goes like 1 over T. So we can estimate the ratio of the scale factor today to the scale factor at recombination as just like a ratio of temperatures, right? So we need to know the temperature of the photons today. That's the temperature of the CMB. And the temperature at recombination there. And then the scale factor today is 1, and we can relate this to the redshift at recombination. T today is like 2.7 degrees Kelvin. Okay, and so if we stick in some numbers, the redshift at recombination is like 1400, 1380. Okay. So if we kept going, you know, yeah, that's not what I want. Other way around. No, that's what I wanted, sorry. So at high temperatures, x is of order 1, there's lots of electrons around, and then at low temperatures, they go away. And here, this is around 3760 Kelvin. So you could solve that fully, and you'd get a graph like this from the Saha equation. If you went back and you really wanted to do a careful job, then you just need to solve the full Boltzmann equation. And so if you really want to work with the CMB, then that's what you do. You solve the full Boltzmann equation, and there are codes that will do that for you and tell you the recombination history. So how does the ionization fraction evolve with time or temperature? Okay, so that's one. And then the next thing that happens is decoupling. So here we've got electrons scattering from photons. But as the ionization fraction drops, there's going to be fewer and fewer electrons around for the photons to scatter with. And so photons and electrons are going to stop interacting when their interaction rate becomes of order Hubble. So that was the freeze-out condition for when things stop talking. Again, you could estimate this better by solving the Boltzmann equations. So you'd need a Boltzmann equation for electrons, protons, hydrogen, and photons. Okay, and you'd solve those four equations. Out would pop recombination, and then you can get to decoupling. Okay, so first we need the rate. And the rate is given by the number density of electrons times the thermally averaged cross-section. Okay, so this, basically is the Thomson cross-section. And then the photons are Z. So this is just approximately equal to the Thomson cross-section times C, but we're in units where C equals 1, so let's forget about that. And then we need the number density of electrons. And so the number density of electrons, we need the ionization fraction. Okay, so that's how many baryons are electrons. And then we need to know how baryons are diluting. Okay, so we need to know how many there are and how they're diluting. Okay, so the fraction of the baryons times rho crit is the baryon mass density. Okay, and then how many electrons are there? Well, we just divide by the mass, the electrons. And then they dilute like 1 plus Z cubed. So 1 over A cubed. Okay, and then we've got our Thomson cross-section. Okay, on the left-hand side, so this should be of order Hubble when decoupling happens. And we can assume, since this happens at a redshift of 1300, and matter radiation equality we solved for before happened at a redshift of like 3000, that we're in the matter-dominated regime. And so basically, we can get Hubble by assuming matter domination. Okay. So one way to write that is in terms of the density parameter, omega matter. Okay, so Hubble squared is proportional to omega matter, and that dilutes like 1 over A cubed. Okay, we take the square root, we get 3/2. Great, so we're pretty much there. Now we just need to solve for the redshift at which the left-hand side equals the right-hand side. So we need to know in detail this ionization fraction. We've got a factor of 1 plus Z to the 3/2 power that we get by canceling off a little bit there. And then the right-hand side, we just have a bunch of constants. So there's a H naught, omega matter to the 1/2 power. There's an omega baryon. There's the critical density, factor of the mass of the electron, and then a Thomson cross-section. So these are all constants that we can gather. And then we can solve a little bit more carefully in the Saha equation. If you look in the notes, this is possible to solve for x. And then out will come a redshift. And the redshift that comes out is like 1100. And so as expected, first Recombination happens. You remove some of the electrons, and then there are too few of them to interact with the photons, and so then the photons and the electrons stop interacting. Okay, and that's decoupling. Okay, and then the last event was last scattering. So if gamma is the interaction rate, then I can count the number of times an average photon will interact with an electron by integrating this over time. That gets a name. It's called the optical depth. And the optical depth basically just counts how many times photons scatter as they propagate. I'll give this a little O because I also use tau for the conformal time. Sadly, either the letter tau or the letter eta is used for conformal time, but then both tau and eta are used for other things like the optical depth and then the slow roll parameters, which we'll introduce later. And so it is impossible for me to choose a consistent set, and therefore this will just be O. But that's not conformal time. Ian?
Okay, so for the baryon number density, should you use the mass of the proton rather than mass of electron?
Probably yes. Thank you. Yes, and the universe is electrically neutral, so there should be just as many electrons as there were protons. Thank you for catching that. That's wrong in the notes, I'll fix that. Okay, so this is the optical depth. If a photon is released at some time t, and it propagates to me at a time t naught, then this counts backward in time how many times the photon scattered. So let's say we're up here. And here's our photon. We're at t naught, and this is t. So this is counting along the path back to a certain time how many times this photon is scattered on its way to me. Okay. When this is equal to 1, that means that there is a time at which a photon scatters exactly once, and that's what we mean by last scattering. Okay? So it scattered here and then propagated to me, and then an average photon never scattered again. Okay? And we can solve for when this happens. So we want to do this integral. Okay, so this is the interaction rate integrated over time. We have this nice expression for the interaction rate as a function of redshift. So we could just change variables and then stick that in there. Okay, and so if we were to perform that integral, again, using a solution for x as a function of z, then we would find we're integrating now z. So z today is 1. And this z at last scattering. that this basically happens at decoupling, which sort of makes sense, right? This is when things stop communicating, and so that's around the time when the last scattering would happen for this photon. All right, and then basically after this time of last scattering, these photons are free to travel. So remember what we showed before, at some point, that after these photons stop interacting, they're going to obey the collisionless Boltzmann equation, right? Or even better, let's use this one. So if the distribution function for photons was the Bose-Einstein distribution, then basically all that's going to happen is that the temperature is going to evolve as we've derived, like 1 over the scale factor, right? And that will be the distribution of energies for photons that we observe today after last scattering, right? So these photons are in thermal equilibrium with the electrons. They get a black body spectrum because they basically just stay in equilibrium until they stop interacting with those electrons. Okay? And eventually, we observe them today because they haven't scattered with anything really very much. Turns out there's a really interesting caveat to that statement, which we will talk in great depth about. Because at some point, the first stars form, they ionize neutral hydrogen. You get a bunch of free electrons again, and then CMB photons can scatter in the present universe, like after a redshift of about 6. Okay, and that leads to the polarization of the CMB and all sorts of interesting other effects. But anyway, to leading approximation, they don't interact with anything, and so we see a black body spectrum of photons today. Another kind of corollary to this is that before this time of decoupling, the universe was opaque, right? So the number of scatters, if we look over here, we go back in time past the time of last scattering. Tau is going to end up getting really, really big. That means photons scatter a lot, so they scatter very efficiently with the free electrons. Basically you can think of this surface of last scattering as like the cloud deck of the universe. Photons don't travel, well, they scatter all around in the clouds until they get to the bottom and then they come to you and you get a little bit of light on a cloudy day. But this time here of last scattering is kind of like the cloud deck for the universe. And that's basically the boundary of the observable universe, if we qualify observable as observed with photons. We found that neutrinos stop interacting with protons and neutrons at an earlier time. Okay, so if we had a telescope that could observe the cosmic neutrino background, which you'll study in your homework, then the observable universe would be a little bit bigger. Eventually, if we can observe gravitational waves from the early universe directly with an interferometer, well, gravitons interact really weakly with other stuff, okay? And so then the observable universe would basically go back all the way to the Big Bang or whatever happened at an extremely early time, okay? And so then the observable universe would be even a little bit bigger, okay? But in each of those cases, for the neutrinos and for gravitational waves, you could do the same thing and like calculate the surface of last scattering, which is just determined by this interaction rate, And you'd find that, that the weaker the interaction, the further out you get to go. Okay, so that's kind of the thermal history of the universe as far as I'd like to go. There are lots of interesting things you can do with respect to earlier times and talk about new physics. There's a huge body of work related to doing all of this extremely carefully, where you have to worry about like the 100th energy level of the hydrogen atom and then solve like a coupled set of hundreds of Boltzmann equations to really get all of this right. Think about helium recombination, because 25% of the baryons are helium, so you should think about that, right? That's an important contribution. Think about deviations from the black body spectrum that arise due, for example, to not assuming that the photons are not affected by these processes, that their distribution function can change. That leads to lines in recombination. They're tiny because baryon to photon ratio is huge, but they're there, and that's something that people talk about observing in the future. Eventually, when the universe reionizes, it screws up this distribution function a little bit. That leads to something called the thermal Sunyaev-Zeldovich effect that's really interesting and observed and is gonna be interesting in the future, and so on and so forth. So there's really a lot to do here beyond this four chalkboards. And there's a really interesting body of literature, and I encourage you, if you're interested, to come talk to me or to check it out on Google. Okay, but we're gonna leave it at that. And now let's move on to talk about the big picture stuff, okay? So we've kind of described a little bit the homogeneous universe, how it expands and evolves, how the stuff in it evolves to a certain extent. But now let's step back and try and ask where it all came from. Okay. So, here's a basic statement that's kind of true about almost everything we do in physics, except for in cosmology, it gets a little bit weird. Most of the language that we know how to describe physics is in terms of differential equations. So we've got laws of dynamics, right? But what's necessary for those laws of dynamics to have any predictive power is a set of initial conditions, right? We don't think about that usually as weird for, quote, normal everyday physics, because we get to control the initial conditions. We get to set up experiments where we can control what goes in and then test our laws of dynamics. But cosmology is weird because we can't do that, right? We just get to see the universe as it is. And then really what we get is a combination. Right, we get some combination of whatever the initial conditions were and whatever the dynamical laws were. But we can't really separate those. We can only make assumptions about what those initial conditions might have been, and assumptions that physics is the same here on Earth as it is in the cosmos, so that I can apply the physical laws I learn about in the lab to things that I observe in the cosmos. So there are lots of ideas and attempts for what goes in to those initial conditions, what makes an attractive set of initial conditions. Do I need an infinite number of universes to describe the initial conditions? Is the universe eternal? Is it finite? And so on and so forth, okay? But before we get to those ideas, let's just step back and ask, like, well, okay, given everything we observe, what sorts of initial conditions do we need to explain? So let's make a few general comments. So we have our Robertson-Walker metric, which is what we think describes the universe on sufficiently large scales. So what goes in here? So the scale factor is some function of time. And at some point, if we extrapolate back, if we just have matter, radiation, cosmological constant, maybe curvature, then we're going to reach A equals zero at some finite time, at some finite proper time in the past. Okay? That's what we like to call the Big Bang. And so what we can say is that at t approximately equal to zero, we need these initial conditions. Another basic feature of the Robertson-Walker space-time in our universe, at least A dot is bigger than zero. Okay, so part of those initial conditions too is a derivative, right? So why is A dot positive and not negative, right? Well, there could be a really easy answer to that. If it was negative, then the universe just would have crunched up into a singularity. We wouldn't be here to talk about it, and that might be the answer. Okay, but nevertheless, there needs to be some reason. We have to say why A dot is greater than zero, not less than zero. Okay. What else? So the scale factor from all the stuff we know and love has grown quite a bit, right? At least from the time of the CMB, the scale factor has grown by a factor of 1,000. That's the part we get to see. Then we can extrapolate further back. We could say if there's BBN, well, then the universe needed to be even bigger, like 1,000 times bigger than that. BBN happened at a redshift of like 1,000,000. So A grew by at least factor, let's say, like 1,000,000,000. So our universe is big and old, and we need to explain why that is. Okay, and then there's the ingredients. So, all right, to get that scale factor as a function of time, we need to solve the Friedmann equation. Okay. And to explain the stuff that we see in our universe, we need radiation, we need matter. There's no evidence for curvature right now, but let's put it there just for fun. And then we need lambda, okay? And so at a really early time, A was small and radiation dominated, okay? So at that early time, we needed the right set of ingredients or the right dynamics, like all this stuff about the thermal evolution of the universe, such that we ended up with the right amount of matter. And that statement is detailed too, because, well, what do we need? We need both baryons and dark matter. We need more matter than antimatter. Otherwise, the numbers would not work out right, and so on and so forth. Okay. So we needed the right stuff around, you know, at early times, such that it evolved at later times into the stuff that we see. Another kind of puzzling thing is this guy, right? So lambda, if dark energy is really a cosmological constant, somehow when the universe was super hot and dense, it needed to know that there should be this incredibly tiny energy density around, so that just, you know, billions of years, 10 billion years later, it takes over and drives the universe to undergo accelerated expansion. That's a super big question mark. Why? How was that set up in the initial conditions somehow? Okay, so there are sort of the ingredients question, like how in the initial conditions do we end up with this distribution of stuff? With relation to curvature, so omega k, we could either have positive or negative curvature if it's non-zero. And today, this is given by the Hubble constant times the radius of curvature. That was the constant that was in that S kappa. So it's either R, big R sine, little r over big R, or sinh. It tells us how far out we have to go before we notice that the universe does not have Euclidean geometry. And we observe this to be small. This is like got to be less than about 10 to the minus 3. And so somehow also in the initial conditions, there needs to be this hierarchy of scales between the curvature radius and the Hubble parameter, right? So there needs to be this hierarchy. So how did in the initial conditions, how did the universe know that it needed to make the radius of curvature big enough that the universe today could be approximately flat? Okay, so that's all kind of about the ingredients. Like in the initial conditions, we need to specify the right ingredients such that at late times, far later than this tiny scale factor, we end up with the right conditions that we observe today. And then there's like the most basic assumption that goes in to this whole business that we started with on the first day. Like the universe on large scales has to be approximately homogeneous and isotropic. Otherwise, that ansatz for the metric that we're using in all of cosmology is wrong, right? So somehow that also has to come out of the initial conditions. So, let's riff on this one for a little while. I'm going to give you a little bit of a preview of the stuff we'll cover in part two, because I'd like to set that up, because it makes, I think, the answering what we need to explain a little bit more clear. Because it's not only this. So the universe is approximately homogeneous and isotropic, but the the inhomogeneities in it have some pretty special properties. The study of those properties is basically cosmological perturbation theory, which will be what we do next. But let's talk about it a little bit. So this will be a little bit of an aside. So let's start with some definitions. Okay, so density perturbations, if we have the density of matter, baryons, dark matter, radiation, whatever. We can write this as a mean density that depends only on time. That's the thing we've studied thus far. But times one plus small perturbations that can in general depend on position and time, okay? Where delta is much less than one is our assumption to make this description useful. Okay, so density perturbations coupled to gravity. Okay, so you may remember that a lump of stuff in Newtonian gravity, the way we tell it gravitates is we solve the Poisson equation for the gravitational potential. And we can do the same in cosmology. Leaving aside some subtleties, if we're in the right coordinate system, the following is true. Okay, so the sum of all the mean densities times the fluctuations gravitates and sources a Newtonian potential phi. Okay. So we can define from this equation two types of density perturbations. There are adiabatic perturbations. Okay, those are the ones where the sum gives me something that is not zero. Okay, so fluctuations in the density that source a Newtonian potential. So-called adiabatic fluctuations. We can also have isocurvature fluctuations. Which is what I get if this sum were to be zero. So how does that happen? I make a hole and then I fill the hole with something else. Okay, right now. I gouge a hole in the wall and then I fill it up with putty. That's an isocurvature perturbation. Okay, in our universe, we believe the fluctuations to be almost entirely adiabatic. There's one exception to that, which is pretty interesting. So, if we took baryons and dark matter, they both dilute in the same way, and I traded baryons for dark matter and I made an isocurvature perturbation, that could actually be 10 to the 5 times bigger than the adiabatic perturbations, and we wouldn't know anything yet, interestingly. That one's really hard to detect. But for the most part, this is true. Okay. Okay, so that's a special property of the inhomogeneities in our universe. They seem to be adiabatic. In that all of the density perturbations around, they don't mix up in some special way, but they just source phi. Okay. So there's two ways to interpret the Poisson equation. It's a constraint equation. It's not a dynamical equation because it only has spatial derivatives. Okay. So one way to think about it is that rho gives you phi. And that's the usual way we like to think about it, because I have a planet, it makes a gravitational field, right? And then I think about how that makes stuff fall in it. On the other hand, another way to think about it, I have a gravitational potential and stuff falls into it, right? So if I have phi, that can generate delta rho. Let's say delta, actually. Okay. So if I have a gravitational potential, things can fall into it and make in homogeneities.
Do we suppose something on the behavior of our delta function at infinities? Does it has to decrease, or does it have to decrease or not? Or something that makes sense?
Yeah, so great question. We don't really know much about the appropriate boundary conditions for cosmology. We just know out to the observable universe. The universe could be way bigger than that, in which case the answer to your question is it doesn't matter because they might fall off really far away past where we could ever see, or they might blow up, but I would never know, right? So it's kind of a relevant observational question. The universe, if it was closed, then in fact you'd need a periodicity and not a fall off, yeah? The universe, if it did have, if we did allow things to blow up, then it turns out there are interesting quantities that are allowed to blow up that don't give rise to any kind of singularities or crazy stuff that are kind of coordinate artifacts. So there are really a lot of different things that we don't know about those boundary conditions. And because of that, many different boundary conditions are possible. Yeah. However, with that being said, the next topic is we like to work because delta is small. We can apply the tools of linear theory. And the tools of linear theory are best applied in Fourier space. Okay. And as soon as I write the following equation down, I have assumed something about boundary conditions because Fourier transforms assume something about boundary conditions. Okay. Okay, so we can take our fluctuations in the density, and we can decompose them into Fourier modes. Okay. So these density fluctuations, that's a real field, density as a function of place and time. These Fourier coefficients are complex in general, but with a constraint that delta star evaluated at k has got to equal delta evaluated at minus k. Okay, that's, if you remember from QFT, the assumption you need to make to get a real field. So the Fourier transform, because x is a co-moving position, then k is a co-moving wave number. So it described, the magnitude of k describes a wave with some co-moving wavelength lambda, and lambda does not change with the expansion of the universe, right? So these waves expand with the expansion of the universe if we were to think about them in physical coordinates. They are constant in co-moving coordinates, constant wavelength. Okay. So another reason it's convenient to think in Fourier space is that the statistics of these fluctuations can be described in a reasonably simple way. Okay. So we can define a power spectrum. So that's if I imagine I have a bunch of realizations of the density field, or I have a huge volume and I look at different subvolumes of the density field, I can take an ensemble average, okay? And that ensemble average, sorry, I don't define it with a 2 pi here. Given by a delta function times a quantity called the power spectrum, which is a function only of the magnitude of k. And time in general. Okay, so that is a statement about a physics fact that is quite important. So because the power spectrum is only a function of the magnitude of k, that encodes an assumption about statistical isotropy, that the statistics of the density field does not depend on where I am in space. Okay. We can see that by calculating not the correlation between density Fourier modes, but correlations between the density field at different places in space. Okay, so we can get this from this by using the definition of the Fourier transform. Which we do again, but I tell you the answer now so we can move quickly through this. So this is an integral dk over 2 pi squared k squared p of k and t. And this turns out to be a function only of the distance between two points. And that's what we mean by statistical isotropy. It's that the correlations between the density at different places does not depend on where I am, but only the distance between points. So here, actually, we see immediately why is it useful to work with these Fourier modes. And that's because the Fourier modes don't couple between different k's. Right? They're independent. But the density field is correlated at different positions. Yep.
So we confused with what average is this? Average over.
Yeah, good. So we either imagine I've got many universes and I take an ensemble average over many universes. Or we could take the universe, split it up into a bunch of boxes, and then take an ensemble average over all those boxes. Those would turn out to be the same thing if I had an infinitely big universe, for example.
What's our measure then?
What's that?
What's our measure? Say, what's the weight we give to?
I get there in 1 second. Okay. So the answer is it depends on our assumption about the statistics of the field. But let's get there in a second. So what else do I want to say? Okay, density at different positions is correlated. P you can see has units of length cubed. If we want to get this thing to be dimensionless, then we need to cancel off the 3 powers of k. Sometimes it's useful to define something related to P, which is fancy P. Beware, because this is called the power spectrum, and this is called the power spectrum. Okay. In some references, this will be fancy P, and this will be uppercase P. But we go to how it's defined. You put this definition into this integral, and you evaluate it where x equals x prime, then you'll find that this is the integral dk over k of fancy p. Okay, so it's the power per unit log interval. Okay, so it's the power per decade in scale. Okay, just one more definition, and then I will answer your question. So if I have an equal power per logarithmic interval in k contributing to the fluctuations at a point in space, at the variance of delta at a point in space, then we call that a scale invariant spectrum. So if p, fancy p, is equal to a constant, then we call that a scale invariant spectrum. In our universe, if we look at the spectrum of fluctuations, not of in density, but in phi, the gravitational potential, turns out that this is the thing that is approximately scale invariant. Where this is about 10 to the minus 9, the amplitude of that scale invariant power spectrum is like 10 to the minus 9. And the deviation from scale invariance is determined by ns. If ns was 1, then it would be scale invariant. Ns is like 0.96, so it's really close to 1, but not exactly 1. So in our universe, the power spectrum of fluctuations is almost scale invariant. And it has a really tiny amplitude. Just write that down. Okay, so it's almost scale invariant, and the fluctuations in the gravitational potential are really tiny. Okay, so now what the measure is. So how do we determine the statistics of this density field? Like, what is the ensemble that we imagine? Okay. So a Gaussian field is defined as a field where the Fourier coefficients, and we consider this to be a multivariate distribution over the Fourier coefficients and the complex conjugate of the Fourier coefficients. Okay. So this if we have a Gaussian field, then the Fourier coefficients are drawn from a Gaussian distribution. Where the width of the Gaussian is the power spectrum, okay, evaluated at different k. So if we wanted to make a fake universe full of fluctuations, we would basically draw at random delta and delta star from a Gaussian probability distribution. And when we take the ensemble averages up here, if we had a Gaussian field, they're defined with respect to this ensemble. This is like the likelihood function for the fluctuations. Okay, and then our universe, it seems, is described by Gaussian random fields. So for example, P phi, the fluctuations in the Newtonian potential, or the fluctuations in the density, really, are all random Gaussian fields. You can measure deviations from Gaussianity. So for example, for a Gaussian probability distribution, the three-point function would be zero. Okay. How would I get that? Well, like schematically, you'd integrate three powers of delta against your probability density, right? And then x cubed times a Gaussian is zero. So if it really was a Gaussian, then you'd get zero. But we can parameterize deviations using something called the bispectrum. So we can get a delta function of the three k's that this thing, if I have three powers of delta, they're each function of k. So we could parameterize this as a constant times a delta function times some arbitrary function of the three k's. Okay. If we think about the amplitude, so the amplitude here, it's like three powers of k. Okay. So if f and l was equal to 1, then this thing should be approximately equal to the power spectrum to the 3/2 power. That's three powers of delta. So we measure this parameter. We don't measure it. We constrain it. It's like about less than 5. Okay. So if p is determined by this amplitude of 10 to the minus 9, then 10 to the minus 9 to the 3/2 power is far smaller than. Well, so basically, we constrain it to be Gaussian to one part in like a million. It's pretty good. So in our universe, things seem to be pretty darn Gaussian. Another thing about a Gaussian field is that you can characterize the Gaussian field entirely by its power spectrum. Right, so that's like all the information there is in this field. It's just all in the power spectrum. Question?
Yeah. How would this fluctuation enter like a Friedmann equation with something non-Gaussian, like something not homogeneous? Because it's small, but the cosmological constant is small too. So is it comparable to that, or is there something you can say?
Well, so all of these fluctuations, if they're really small, then at leading order in perturbation theory, you solve for the Friedmann backgrounds, and then you solve for the evolution of these perturbations on top of it. Now you can ask, okay, well, what happens when they get big? Because our universe does have big fluctuations, like galaxies and us and stars, whatever, right? And then what you need to do is go back to the full Einstein equations and see how do those things now change the geometry. There was a very long, interesting debate about whether or not that could do something super interesting, like somehow do a bunch of points gravitate differently than a continuous medium. And there were arguments that this difference could explain the accelerated expansion of the universe. But then people came along, solved Einstein's equations on the computer, and showed rigorously that when you have a bunch of density fluctuations that collapse into galaxies, that those galaxies just make the universe expand like a continuous medium. So there's a detailed question of what happens when those fluctuations get big, but you can go back, turn the crank, solve Einstein's equations, and see what happens. And more or less the answer is nothing really that interesting happens to the homogeneous background. If that didn't happen, that would be like terrible news for cosmology, because one of the reasons we can do cosmology is that we can basically separate the mean expansion with all these average densities from all the fluctuations, right? If that wasn't possible, we'd need to know where all the galaxies in the universe were to figure out how it expanded. Way harder. So gladly things work like that way. Okay, so to recap, we've got these inhomogeneities, and I've listed some of their special properties thus far. Okay, so they're adiabatic. They're small, which means I can describe them with linear theory. They are nearly Gaussian fields, meaning that we can explain the likelihood function of those fluctuations from a Gaussian distribution. And the power spectrum that appears in the Gaussian distribution is approximately scale invariant. Okay. And there we are. Okay, so those are some of the special properties of the inhomogeneities in our universe that we need to explain by our initial conditions. And I will begin next time by talking about some other properties of those fluctuations, and then we will talk about inflation, which will be an idea that is going to help us to set the right initial conditions to explain all these special properties. So we'll pick it up next time and go from there. By the way, the notes corresponding to this and Thursday's lecture are now on the wiki, so you can check those out.